Picture a Hawaiian fisherman in January 1778 paddling frantically toward shore, eyes wide with terror. Behind him loom two massive ships with fire burning atop them and strange holes puncturing their sides. On deck stand creatures with deformed heads, actually tricorn hats, and loose and folding skin, European uniforms. As thousands gather on the beach, a collective shiver runs through the crowd. Everyone senses the same truth. Their world is about to change forever. This moment captures the essence of Captain James Cook's third and final voyage, an expedition that would chart unknown waters, bridge vastly different cultures, and end in shocking violence. Cook had already become history's greatest explorer, disproving the existence of a mythical southern continent and mapping vast stretches of the Pacific. Yet this journey would reveal something more profound than geography, the devastating complexity of first contact between civilizations. What happens when the most celebrated navigator of his age meets cultures that have thrived for millennia without European discovery? The answer is far more nuanced than simple conquest or collaboration. At 46, Cook had earned his rest. After 7 grueling years at sea, he'd accepted a comfortable position at Greenwich Hospital. Good pay, minimal work, time with family. He'd written that he hoped he'd put an end to all voyages to the Pacific Ocean. Yet within months, restlessness consumed him. "A few months ago, the whole Southern Hemisphere was hardly big enough for me," he lamented, "and now I am going to be confined within the limits of Greenwich Hospital, which are far too small for an active mind like mine." When the Admiralty planned a new expedition searching for the Northwest Passage, Cook couldn't resist. During a dinner with naval officials, he suddenly rose and declared he would lead it himself. Cook embodied Enlightenment ideals, the belief that empirical observation could unlock nature's secrets. He approached new cultures with scientific curiosity, documenting indigenous societies with unusual tolerance. He rarely moralized, never forced Christianity on natives, and often went ashore first and unarmed. What captivated him weren't riches or territory, but moments of pure discovery, opportunities to study, measure, and document the entirely new. Mai, the first Pacific Islander to visit England, became an instant sensation when Joseph Banks presented him to King George III. His nervous greeting, "How do, King Tosh?" charmed the monarch. He toured St. Paul's Cathedral, visited Cambridge, and sat for portraits by England's celebrated artists. Joshua Reynolds painted him on a monumental 8-foot canvas, posed like classical nobility. He mastered chess and cards, once defeating Italian intellectual Giuseppe Baretti. Even cantankerous Samuel Johnson admitted, "There is so little of the savage in Omai." Yet beneath this social triumph lay profound displacement. Mai never forgot his true mission, mastering firearms to avenge his father's death and reclaim his family lands from Bora Boran invaders. When Cook's third voyage returned him to the Pacific, the homecoming proved bittersweet. His English wealth created social instability. In the Society Islands, private wealth was like a sore on a healthy body. He died around 1780 from a throat infection likely introduced by a Spanish ship. Before his death, he achieved his goal. Using his English weapons, he fought bravely against the Bora Borans, helping win a decisive victory and avenging his father, though he never permanently reclaimed his lands. Something was changing in Cook. Once known for equanimity, he now seemed restless and occasionally tyrannical. Some speculate physical ailments, sciatica, gallbladder disease, or vitamin deficiency, contributed to his erratic behavior and increasingly frequent floggings. The darkness emerged dramatically at Morea when a stolen goat prompted Cook to order every house burned. His men torched huts, destroyed crops, slaughtered livestock, and confiscated food stores in a campaign that shocked his own officers. This wasn't isolated. Months earlier in Tonga, Cook had ordered natives flogged beyond navy limits, cut off ears, and carved a cross into one man's shoulder. But Moraya's widespread destruction represented something more disturbing: collective punishment of an entire community for one theft. The man celebrated for cultural sensitivity was becoming the imperial enforcer. Yet Cook's mission continued with relentless determination. After leaving Hawaii, he traced nearly the entire Alaska coast through brutal weather, constant rain, fog, and gales. By August, he'd accomplished something monumental, determining North America's exact width by measuring Cape Prince of Wales, the continent's westernmost point. He even dashed across the Bering Strait to set foot on Asia. But when massive ice packs blocked further progress, he made a fateful decision: winter in Hawaii rather than cold Kamchatka. In January 1779, Cook's ships entered Kealakekua Bay to an extraordinary reception. 10,000 Hawaiians in wild celebration, over 1,000 canoes surrounding the ships, tumultuous chanting echoing off volcanic cliffs. When Cook stepped ashore, people prostrated themselves, chanting "Lono, Lono, Lono." Lieutenant James King found it disturbing, noting it seemed to approach to adoration. Was Cook truly mistaken for Lono, the Hawaiian god of fertility and peace? The question has sparked centuries of scholarly debate. Some argue Cook's arrival during Makahiki, the annual festival honoring Lono, created mistaken identity. Others insist Hawaiians recognized Cook as a powerful chief, not a literal deity. Cook participated in elaborate ceremonies, possibly to secure goodwill and supplies. For 2 weeks, harmony prevailed. Cook met King Kalaniopuu, who arrived with 150 war canoes. Despite his frail appearance, inflamed eyes, scurfy skin from kava consumption, the elderly king possessed unmistakable charisma and a countenance very expressive of conscious dignity and merit. As Cook prepared to depart, he requested the Heiau Temple's wooden fence for kindling. Though the priest allowed it, Cook's men also removed wooden god statues, an act Hawaiians watched with dismay as strangers dismantled their sacred space. On February 4th, thousands of Hawaiians cheered as the ships departed. Then fate intervened. During a violent squall, the Resolution's foremast split. Cook had no choice but to return to Kealakekua Bay. When the ships reappeared on February 14th, the reception was starkly different. Hawaiians were hostile and suspicious. When the Discovery's cutter was stolen, Cook devised his standard response: blockade the shore and kidnap the king as hostage. It had worked before in Tahiti and Tonga. On the morning of February 14th, Cook and Lieutenant Phillips escorted the cooperative king toward shore. But hundreds of angry Hawaiians gathered, their fury triggered by news that Lieutenant Rickman had killed an important chief. The king's wife begged him not to board. Cook finally realized he couldn't force the king aboard without killing many, but stubbornly refused to retreat. What happened next unfolded with terrible inevitability. Cook fired his flintlock, killing a Hawaiian, the first person he had ever killed. At the water's edge, a Hawaiian struck him with a club. When Cook groaned in pain, the crowd shouted, "He is no god. Let us kill him. He is only a man." Nua, the king's attendant, drove a pahoa dagger deep into Cook's neck. Cook collapsed into a tide pool where others held his face down while Nua repeatedly stabbed him. Cook, four Marines, and as many as 20 Hawaiian warriors lay dead. Hawaiian elders insist Cook's remains received the respect accorded their most revered chiefs. In Hawaiian tradition, bodies of important figures were burned and dismembered, with flesh scraped from bones where spiritual force, mana, resided. These bones became powerful relics distributed among high chiefs. On February 21st, Cook's funeral was held aboard the Resolution, his weighted coffin lowered into Kealakekua Bay, followed by 10 cannon shots. The expedition continued under Charles Clerk's command, completing what was then the longest exploratory voyage ever undertaken, 1,548 days, before returning to England in October 1780. Kamehameha the Great reportedly paraded a coffin containing Cook's bones during annual Makahiki processions, believing they contained powerful mana. Today, a white obelisk stands near where Cook died, on land deeded to England by Princess Lifelike for $1. The monument remains British soil maintained by the Royal Navy, though it's frequently vandalized with red paint and marked, "You are on native land." Cook's extraordinary achievements, mapping the Pacific, disproving the southern continent theory, discovering countless islands, pioneering scurvy prevention, are now balanced against his role in initiating colonial processes that devastated indigenous populations. His legacy refuses simple categorization. Neither purely heroic nor villainous, Cook embodies the profound cultural collisions that reshaped the Pacific world. His death wasn't just one man's end, it was the violent birth of a new era when isolated worlds could no longer remain separate.